Thank you very much, Vice-Chancellor, and thanks everybody for coming, particularly people who've come from outside the university, but also everybody at what I know is one of the busiest times of the academic year. I'd also like to thank all the people I've had really interesting conversations with over the last few months that have helped to shape this lecture. There's not going to be a PowerPoint presentation, but there will be some dramatised extracts later. On the 25th of October, 1856, an unsigned article headed simply Talk Stoppers appeared in the journal Household Words. We hear a great deal of lamentation nowadays on the decline of the art of conversation, it begins. Old ladies and gentlemen are constantly asking each other why the great talkers of their youthful days have found no successor in this inferior present time. Where, they inquire mournfully, where are the illustrious men and women gifted with a capacity for perpetual outpouring of the tongue? Where are the solo talkers in this degenerate age of choral conversation? Each generation tends to look back with nostalgia, and during the 19th century, the 18th century, with its salons and coffee houses, came to be seen as the golden age of conversation. That faculty, as Jonathan Swift had put it in 1713, which is held to be the great distinction between men and brutes. Here, though, the young novelist, Wilkie Collins, is not lamenting the decline of conversation, but sending up those who mourn the demise of the celebrity talkers who came to prominence at the turn of the 19th century, such as the poet Samuel Rogers, whose edited Table Talk also appears in 1856, the wit Sidney Smith and Joseph Jekyll, and the radical Whig politician Richard, known as Conversation Sharp. The solo talkers have vanished, Collins continues. If they could rise from the dead and wag their unresting tongues among us now, would they win their reputations anew? Would they even get listeners? Would they actually be allowed to talk? I venture to say decidedly not. They would surely be interrupted and contradicted. They would hear confidential whispering and perpetual fidgeting in distant corners before they had got through the first dozen eloquent opening sentences. To illustrate his case, Collins imagines a series of encounters between some fictional solo talkers of the previous generation and various 19th century characters. Chief among these is Mr. Spoke Wheeler, one of those men, Collins writes, whose constant practice is to lie silently in ambush for subjects started by other people. Spoke Wheeler is more than a match for the brilliant social luminary Mr. Endless, whose fertility of allusion to topics of past and present alike was truly inexhaustible, according to his admiring editor, Collins writes. Collins describes the dinner table scene. Endless takes the measure of his man, thinks to himself, here is a new worshipper to astonish, plunges his knife and fork, gaily hospitable, into the dish before him, let us say a turkey and truffles, for Endless is a gastronome as well as a wit, and starts off with one of those fertile allusions for which he was so famous. I never carve turkey without thinking of what Madame de Pompadour said to Louis XV, Endless begins in his most offhand manner. I refer to the time when the superb Frenchwoman first came to court and the star of the fair Chateau Roux waned before her. Who remembers what the Pompadour said when the king offered to carve the turkey? Before the company can beg Endless, as usual, to remember for them, Mr. Spoke Wheeler starts into life and seizes the subject. What a vicious state of society it was at the time of Madame de Pompadour, he says with moral severity. No wonder it led to the French Revolution. Everyone wakes politely to hear more of the French Revolution. Mr. Spoke Wheeler has not another word to say. He has snatched his subject, has exhausted it, and is now waiting with an expectant smile on his face to lay hands on another. Wilkie Collins republished Talk Stoppers in his own collection, My Miscellanies, in 1863, stating in the preface that he wished to address the public with something of the ease of letter writing and something of the familiarity of friendly talk. The literary pulpit appeared to me to be somewhat overcrowded with the preachers of lay sermons. The piece first appeared while Collins was on the salaried staff of Household Words, where he worked alongside journalists such as George Augustus Sala and Edmund Yates. This young bohemian set helped develop the more personal style of journalism that emerged after 1850, but it was their editor, Charles Dickens, who determined the journal's policy and who saw Household Words as enabling what many considered to be an increasingly fragmented society to talk to itself. we seek to bring into innumerable homes from the stirring world about us knowledge of many social wonders, good and evil, Dickens wrote in the opening editorial, to bring the greater and the lesser in degree together upon that wide field and mutually dispose them to a better acquaintance and a kinder understanding is one of the main objects of our household words. What Dickens envisages here is a new kind of public realm, one different from what Jürgen Habermas has described as the bourgeois public sphere based on universalist rational values that arose out of merchant capitalism during the 18th century. For Dickens, it is mass communication that holds out the possibility for the first time of a national conversation across and between very different social groups. The encounters that Collins jokingly portrays within the journal, though, are very different from the liberal inclusiveness that Dickens aspired to as editor. Far from singing from the same hymn sheet, Collins's choral conversationalists are constantly at cross purposes. Even when they're brought together in the relatively homogeneous sphere of the dinner party, they refuse to recognise the rules of polite small talk. Household words, and Collins's piece embedded within it, therefore, point to the double-edged idea of conversation in the mid-19th century, how it makes complex communication possible, but also demonstrates how difficult real communication is to achieve. Conversation is a slippery word. Between the 14th and 18th centuries, according to the OED, it could mean the action of living, of having one's being in a place or among persons, together with commerce, intercourse, society, intimacy, linking a more personal feeling of belonging to collective sociability. One of its primary former meanings, too, was sexual intercourse or intimacy, a definition extended in the widespread use of the term criminal conversation for illicit sexual practices. Up until the passing of the Divorce Act in 1857, a divorce by Act of Parliament was preceded by a civil action for criminal conversation by which a husband could sue his wife's lover for damages. There are ambiguities in its more limited sense, too. Conversation overlaps with discussion and dialogue, and while it implies a non-aggressive, ongoing verbal exchange, it often involves explicit or covert forms of contest. As Peter Burke has argued, conversation is ideally based on principles of cooperation and the rights of all participants to speak. It consists of speech acts that are spontaneous and informal and should not be directly utilitarian. But in practice, it rarely takes place in this ideal space. Some form of hierarchy is usually at work. Within groups, conversation is as likely to be competitive as collaborative, and it is always governed by a set of implicit rules. The proliferation of Victorian etiquette manuals, with titles such as The Art of Conversation, Society Small Talk, and my favourite, the evangelical How to Shine in Society, demonstrated the need to make these codes explicit while recognising what we would now call the phatic value of small talk, its role in creating a sense of togetherness rather than actually imparting information. The idea that dialogue is an essential ingredient of both education and democracy is deeply rooted in the Western liberal tradition too. Yet conversation can also be invoked as a means of imposing or manufacturing consent, of basing legitimacy on the performance of a democratic act rather than battling out different positions between equals. These issues are very much alive today. Think of Tony Blair and his big conversation, through which New Labour attempted to refresh its project at the turn of the present century, and how long ago that seems. But whether one thinks of such co-option of informal talk, whatever one thinks of such co-option of informal talk, the idea that a national discussion might engage the whole of a people was crucial to the reshaping of political legitimacy between the Parliamentary Reform Acts of 1832 and 1837. From a notion of rightful power based on a naturalised social hierarchy to a model of political representation rooted in the ideal, if not the reality, of inclusiveness. Who should be involved in the national conversation? What kinds of talk are legitimate and what illegitimate? What conditions are necessary for meaningful dialogue to take place? During the rest of this lecture, I want to explore how the novel in the 19th century was able to participate in this discussion and expand its terms, extending beyond the immediate political realm into more complex power relationships and forms of consciousness through its ability to realise an extraordinary range of talk in different narrative and social settings. "What is the use of a book without pictures or conversation?" asks Alice, just before she falls down the rabbit hole and engages in a series of mind-boggling verbal encounters. The direct reporting of speech, framed by an overarching narrative voice, is a key feature of realist fiction. It enables novels to recreate the rhythms of everyday life and mix the public display of character with the inner exploration of emotions and motives. But conversation also embodies the form's generic slipperiness. In The Dialogic Imagination, the great Russian Marxist critic Mikhail Bakhtin argued that the novel's extraordinary heterogeneity rests on its ability to engage in different kinds of dialogues, which grow out of the form's rootedness in specific social and cultural conditions. These conversations, Bakhtin argued, take place on various levels, in the interchanges that each work of fiction has with the texts that precede and follow it, in the multiple exchanges between readers, characters, and authors that take place in all acts of reading. Yet while Bakhtin's dialogism is based on speech acts that take place before they've become institutionalized on informal talk, it doesn't emphasize the actual conversations that take place within fictions and how these interact with this process of cultural transmission. For in framing talk within an overarching narrative, the novel offers an extended discussion of the possibilities and limitations of conversation itself. The Pickwick Papers, for example, engages in a continual exchange with the picaresque forms of 18th century fiction and with the novels of Fielding, Sterne, and Smollett that Dickens so passionately admired. Interspersed in a kind of conversation are a series of gothic, comic, or grotesque interludes, such as the Bagman story, an account of a dreamlike hallucination in which an antique chair transmogrifies into a little old man in 18th century dress. The work first appeared in monthly parts in 1836 as the posthumous papers of the Pickwick Club, a kind of collective table talk. The opening chapter takes the form of the published Transactions of the Pickwick Corresponding Society, a comic version of the conversazioni, the sharing of knowledge through informed discussion, which, as the historian of science James Secord has argued, played a central role in the development of scientific culture until well into the 19th century. The opening page records Samuel Pickwick reading a paper on speculations on the source of the Hampstead ponds with some observations on the theory of ticklebacks, and notes that this association cannot but entertain a lively sense of the inestimable benefits which must inevitably result from carrying the speculations of that learned man into a wider field, from extending his travels and consequently enlarging his sphere of observation to the advancement of knowledge and the diffusion of learning. These cultural dialogues are extended and transformed by the extraordinary range of actual conversations that appear through the book. Pickwick himself moves from what David Hume described as the learned to the conversable world. He is the embodiment of an ideal sociability at once paternalistic and inclusive. But conversation also unsettles the Pickwick Club's cozy male homosociality. The working class Sam Weller's irrepressible refusal to take a fixed role as Pickwick's servant is enacted in his verbal sparring, describing himself as a mixture or compo of footman, groom, gamekeeper, and seedsman. Sam is both included in the clubbable world and irresistibly transforms it. In contrast, the stranger who is invited into the company turns out to be a confidence trickster whose scams are advanced above all by talking. And it is a disastrous miscommunication with his landlady, Mrs. Bardell, that leads to Pickwick's indictment for breach of promise. For while Pickwick thought he was describing the need to hire a manservant, Mrs. Bardell believed he was proposing marriage. For all his nostalgia for the world of coach-ins and easy hospitality, the Pickwick Papers offers a kind of comic rendition of the double-edged position of conversation in the 19th century that would become urgent in what Thomas Carlyle, 3 years later, termed the condition of England question in his polemical essay on Chartism. With its demand for full manhood suffrage, annual elections, and secret ballots, the Chartist movement of the late 1830s and 1840s was the first sustained attempt to include the male working class in the national conversation. It was also a dialogical movement in Bakhtin's sense of the term. Chartism's key publication, The Northern Star, drew on a wide range of literary and cultural references, romantic poetry as a means of imagining an ideal of equality, radical melodrama and Gothic excess to dramatise the evils of the new poor law. But Chartism also attempted to change the very idea of what constituted political debate. As John Plotz has argued, the movement's leader, Brontë O'Brien, saw the peaceful crowd which carried the Chartist petition to Parliament as an embodied statement that was every bit as articulate as speech. Carlyle also saw the National Petition of 1839 as rewriting the rules of what constitutes intervention in the public arena. The condition of the great body of the people of the country is the condition of the country itself, he wrote. But while O'Brien saw the crowd as a speech act in itself, for Carlyle it consisted of wild, inarticulate souls struggling there like a dumb creature in pain, which needed to be spoken for if meaningful communication between the classes was to happen. Elizabeth Gaskell directly echoed Carlyle's language in the preface to her first novel, Mary Barton, in 1848, stating that she wanted to give some utterance to the agony which from time to time convulses this dumb people through her story of a working class radical who becomes involved in a conspiracy to murder following the failure of the Chartist petition. Round the character of John Barton, all the others formed themselves, Gaskell later wrote. He was my hero, the person upon all my sympathies went. Mary Barton is full of working class talk, with both dialogue and dialect carefully rendered. The cosy hospitality of the Bartons' respectable home at the beginning, the herbalist Alice Wilson's stories of dislocation and migration, the artisan scientist Joe Blee's sophisticated explanations of the natural world. But Gaskell's very sympathy in speaking for John Barton excludes him from this articulate sociality. What I wish to impress, states the narrator of Barton's growing anger, is what the workman thinks and feels. In speaking for him, in conversation with an anxious middle-class readership, Gaskell turns John Barton into the inarticulate figure of Carlyle's imagination. Am I going too fast? Am I gabbling? However, Gaskell's second Condition of England novel of 1854, North and South, completely inverts this structure by following the forced migration of Margaret Hale, a young middle-class woman, from London and the rural South to the manufacturing town of Milton Northern. The novel first appeared in Household Words under Dickens's eagle-eyed editorship, and in some respects it reenacts his aspiration for the journal to bring the greater and the lesser in degree together and mutually dispose them to a better acquaintance and a kinder understanding through this conduit of middle-class femininity. It is Margaret's combination of curiosity, intelligence, and cultural confidence that is able to overcome the entrenched class positions of both John Thornton, the mill owner, and the worker, Nicholas Higgins. And although conflict is finally diffused through the conventional device of Thornton and Margaret's marriage, it is also continually renegotiated throughout the novel in a series of conversations that break down the oppositions implied by its title. Margaret is less likely to engage in a straightforward dialogue, so much as a three-way conversation in which a third figure complicates the opposing terms between the older professional middle class and new money, between rural labourers and urban workers, between different kinds of men and women, between generations. In engaging in a series of encounters with Thornton and her father, with Higgins and his Methodist daughter Bessie, Margaret increasingly questions her own standpoint as she is transformed by her different discussions. It is Elizabeth Gaskell, not Bill Clinton, who invented triangulation. Here, for example, is a snippet from the chapter What is a Strike, where Margaret, having just come from a conversation on labour and capital with Thornton, engages in a discussion with Bessie and Higgins on the legitimacy of striking. I'm just going to read an extract here. And Margaret is read by Carolyn Lambert and Higgins by Peter Blake, and I read Bessie, the Methodist daughter. Okay, so you get this.
But But if the people struck, as you call it, where I come from, as they are mostly all field labourers, the seed would not be sown, the hay got in, the corn reaped.
Well?
Why, what would become of the farmers?
I reckon they'd have either to give up their farms or to give fair rate of wage.
They could not give up their farms all in a minute, however much they might wish to do so, but they would have no hay nor corn to sell that year. And where would the money come from to pay the labourers' wages the next?
I know naught of your ways down south. I have heard they're a pack of spiritless, downtrodden men, welly clemmed to death. We know when we're put upon, and we've too much blood in us to stand it. We just take our hands from our looms and say, you may clem us, but you'll not put upon us, my masters. And be danged to them, they shan't this time.
I wish I lived down south.
There's a deal. There's a deal to bear there. There are sorrows to bear everywhere. There is very hard bodily labour to be gone through, with very little food to give strength.
But it's out of doors and away from the endless, endless noise and sickening heat.
It's sometimes in heavy rain and sometimes in bitter cold. An old man gets racked with rheumatism and bent and withered before his time. Yet he must just work on the same, or else go to the workhouse.
I thought you were so taken with the ways of the South Country.
So I am. I only mean, Bessie, there's good and bad in everything in this world.
And you say they never strike down there?
No, I think they have too much sense.
And I think it's not that they've too much sense, but that they've too little spirit.
Oh, Father, what have you gained by striking? Think of that first strike when Mother died, and how we all had to clem. You the worst of all, and some went beggars all their lives that after.
Aye, that their strike was badly managed. Folk got into the management of it as are either fools or not true men. You'll see, it'll be different this time.
Thanks to Caroline and Peter. Elizabeth Gaskell's Unitarian faith sprang from the rationalist values of the Enlightenment, and North and South represents one of the most optimistic visions of Torque as a social reform in Victorian fiction. The novel concludes with Thornton establishing a kind of paternalistic capitalism with a form of worker representation as well as a staff canteen. Margaret Hale is the pivot of this process. Elsewhere in 19th century fiction, though, skillful talk is the means by which women negotiate and overcome their own marginality. Elizabeth Bennet has only her wit to counter the put-downs of Caroline Bingley and Lady Catherine de Bourgh in Pride and Prejudice. And Jane Eyre's verbal duels with Mr. Rochester are her means as a penniless governess of asserting her equality and independence. Conversation can also highlight women's sense of exclusion from the centres of political power. Phineas Finn, the Irish Catholic MP in Anthony Trollope's Palliser series, attains a foothold in politics through his conversational skills, above all his feminine ability to listen. But for many of the women of the novel, talking marks both the reach and the limit of their authority. Lady Glencora, a central figure in the series, sacrifices emotional fulfilment for marriage to the uncommunicative liberal politician Plantagenet Palliser. And despite her influence, her talk constantly hovers on the edge of what is permitted to be spoken. What a weird, strange creature she was, notes Alice Versavor in Can You Forgive Her? And how she talked, what things she said, and what terrible foreboding she uttered of stranger things that she meant to say. The widow, Marie Max Gersler too, another outsider whose money eventually gives Phineas the resources he needs to establish his career, is also a consummate political operator who both expresses and overcomes her marginality through talk. So great was her fertility in discourse that all conversational grasses seem to grow with her spontaneously, notes the narrator, as Madame Max outlines the political agenda she would set, which makes Chartist demands seem tame. Politically, I would want to vote for everything that could be voted for, she states. Ballot, manhood suffrage, womanhood suffrage, unlimited right of striking, tenant right, education of everybody, annual parliaments, and the abolition at least of the bench of bishops. That is a strong programme, said Phineas. Here talk is used skillfully to express a sense of exclusion while giving women power within the textual world. But Victorian novels are also full of conversations gone wrong, dramatising more disturbing currents, at once social and psychological, that lurked beneath the liberal ideal of the national subject, the rational subject. Fictional solo talkers often manifest uncontrolled, even pathological mental states. Perhaps most disturbing are Tennyson and Browning's dramatic monologues, in which a speaker gradually reveals his morbid obsessions and deeds to the listeners. But Mrs. Nickleby's mental ramblings in Dickens's novel of 1839 are also unsettling as much as comic. Her tendency to run through a dozen complicated sentences addressed to nobody in particular exacerbate both her own delusions and her children's economic and sexual exploitation. In these forms of disordered speech, consciousness is reconfigured to probe how easily a coherent identity can be disrupted when the mind is unable to hold the multiple strands that make up the self together. And it is Dickens' fiction that most powerfully explores how these disordered forms of association are acted out in various kinds of malfunctioning talk, the talk stoppers who lurk beneath the reassuring consensus of household words. Little Dorrit, for instance, is driven by the failure of different kind of speech acts. The sense of incompleteness that haunts its anti-hero Arthur Clemon is sparked by his father's failed deathbed confession and is fueled by Mrs. Clemon's refusal to engage in any kind of meaningful dialogue. Her verbal costiveness is the extension of her physical paralysis. Mr. Dorrit holds court in the Marshalsea prison, a pathetic parody of a Regency solo talker. The sinister Miss Wade isolates herself at the start by refusing to engage in polite small talk. But above all, it is Arthur's encounter with his old flame Flora that acts out the ways in which dysfunctional conversations can both mask and express unresolved tensions. Returning after 20 years in China at the start of the novel, Arthur visits the woman on whom he had heaped all the locked-up wealth of his affection and imagination. But Flora, now a widow, had turned into a caricature of her girlish manner, such as a mama might have presented at her own funeral if she had lived and died in classical antiquity. Her parody of flirtatious femininity is an example of Dickens's uneasy representation of older women, with her tendency to run on at astonishing speed, pointing her conversation at nothing but commas and very few of them. Flora is the voluble counterpart of Mrs. Clemon and Miss Wade's repression. Unable to control what she knows to be a ridiculous volubility, Flora also represents a stream of consciousness that contains its own repressions. And here she is supplemented by her own legacy, her dead husband's aunt, an old lady who, the narrator writes, has a propensity to offer remarks at a deep warning voice, which being totally uncalled for by anything said by anybody and traceable to no association of the idea of ideas, confounded and terrified the mind. Mr. F's aunt, the narrator goes on, may have thrown in these observations on some system of her own, and it may have been ingenious or even subtle, but the key to it was wanted. Feminist critics have suggested that Mr. F's aunt articulates Flora's own displaced anger, and the wider disconnections between strands of conversation in her father's household also dramatise a process of denial that is both psychological and economic. For just as Flora's frustration emerges obliquely via the aunt, who expresses unremitting hostility to Clemon, so her father, the grasping slum landlord Casby, is able to appear as a hospitable patriarch by displacing his exploitation onto his manager, the machine-like Mr. Panks. Here is a dinner table scene taken from Christine Edzard's 1986 adaptation of Little Dorrit with Miriam Margolyes as Flora, which offers, I think, a striking example of Collins's dysfunctional choral conversation. Right. In August 1889, the year of Wilkie Collins's death, another article on the art of conversation appeared in the weighty periodical The 19th Century. Its author, Lord Ribblesdale, starts by confessing that he never remembers any interesting conversations during his childhood. Far from harking back to a golden age, he stresses that the tone of our conversation changes with the shifting needs of our contemporary thought. Different societies have different standards of taste. Conversation has become more specialised, has broken down into a series of different schools or disciplines, each with their own languages and agendas, Ripplesdale argues. But he also sees talk as a form of aesthetic performance, describing what it takes to become a successful wit in detail, for the solo talker returns at the end of the 19th century. He returns most emphatically, of course, in the form of Oscar Wilde, whose written works frequently began as spoken stories, as extended table talk. Unlike Collins's solo talkers, Wilde had no trouble enthralling his listeners. But Wilde, the writer, is more ambivalent about the seductive power of conversation. He played with the idea and grew willful. He tossed it into the air and transformed it, made it iridescent with fancy and winged it with paradox, he writes of the brilliant talker Lord Henry Wotton in The Picture of Dorian Gray. But Wilde also presents Lord Henry, as an emotional vacuum, a kind of psychological vivisectionist, he uses that word, who regards Dorian essentially as an experimental subject. And while dramatic conversation explodes at the fin de siècle in the plays of Wilde, Shaw and Ibsen, fictional talk is often haunted by various kinds of displaced communication. Pickwick may have found himself in prison as a result of a misunderstanding, but two of the most unbearable scenes in the whole of the literary canon take place as a result of conversations gone horribly wrong. In Tess of the D'Urbervilles, Tess fatally misreads the unspoken rules in recounting her past seduction to Angel Clare on their marriage night. Her belief in mutual speaker rights leads to her abandonment and sets in train the novel's tragic denouement. Sue Bridehead, in contrast, is too egalitarian in her conversation with the morbidly precocious little Father Time in Jude the Obscure. Her inappropriate honesty results in the child hanging himself and his siblings because we are too many. And as face-to-face contact starts to be replaced by long-distance communication with the invention of the telephone, the phonograph, but there are claims of psychical researchers that it might be possible to hold communication with the dead. Fictional talk, too, is suffused by communication with the absent in H.G. Wells's Invisible Man, in Professor Higgins's desire to record Eliza Doolittle's speech on a phonograph in Shaw's Pygmalion, in the real or imagined exchanges between Miles and Flora and Peter Quint in Henry James's The Turn of the Screw, in James's wider preoccupation with what lies beneath the surface of the most apparently innocent exchange. Only connect, E.M. Forster's phrase from Howards End, is often invoked to stress the need to keep dialogue going, even in the most intractable situations. Though published in 1910, this is perhaps the last Victorian Condition of England novel, and it pulls together some of the many forms and uses of conversation in the Victorian novel I've explored and takes them into the 20th century. For Howards End is an extended conversation on conversation itself, and with it the liberal ideal of inclusiveness. The cosmopolitan and vociferous sisters Margaret and Helen Schlegel bear a family resemblance to Margaret Hale. Like Gaskell's heroine, they believe they can overcome differences in wealth and values through enlightened talk. Margaret by marrying the entrepreneur Henry Wilcox, Helen through her attempt to befriend the poverty-stricken clerk Leonard Bast. But Henry never noticed the lights and shades that existed in the greyest conversations. And while Leonard describes his discussion with Helen as one of the finest things in my life, it is Henry's careless talk to the Schlegel sisters, offhandedly telling them that Leonard's workplace is about to go bankrupt and that thus leading to his losing his job, that costs Leonard his livelihood and finally his life. Ironically, it is Leonard and Helen's criminal conversation, a sex act rather than a speech act, that conceives the child who offers most hope for the future. Only Connect, Howards End, like so much 19th century fiction, embodies what Forster calls the finger posts, the milestones, the collisions, the illimitable views of conversation, and dramatises its limits. This is a paradox that can only be conveyed by dialogue itself. Discussion keeps a house alive. It cannot stand by bricks and mortar alone, Margaret tells the enigmatic first Mrs. Wilcox near the beginning of the novel. It cannot stand without them, she replies. Thank you.